Hi, I'm Janelle.
And I'm Monique.
And welcome to Is Marriage Worth It?
We are just two single chicks, girls, women.
Anything but females.
Trying to figure out what marriage is like and is it worth it?
I'm assuming the best place to get the answers is from married people. Maybe engaged people, newlyweds, and even other singles.
Each episode, we will have a guest answering different questions we have or that you may have about marriage.
Join us as we try to figure out, is marriage worth it?
And if it is, I wonder if my future husband or yours is listening right now.
Hi, I'm Monique.
And I'm Janelle.
And welcome back to another episode of
Is Marriage Worth It?
So our guests today are Edith and Trevor. The way that they became a guest, one of our listeners actually saw their anniversary post on Facebook and said, hey, they might be an interesting guest for you guys to have on your podcast. So I reached out to Edith and she got back to me and said that they were willing to be a part of this talk. So thank you guys so much for accepting the invitation to be on the podcast.
You're welcome. You're welcome.
So to kick things off, can you just tell us a little bit about yourselves?
Well, I can get started, but
right ahead.
We have been married for 54 years. We have traveled. We do a lot of traveling. We have done marriage seminars and workshops around the country and some other countries in the world. And been on the continent of Africa and did some workshops there. But we have done quite a few. And we've been doing this for about 40 years.
Wow.
Wow.
So I'm Edith. I'm a social worker. I'm a mother of two adult children, a grandmother of four lovely grandchildren, nearly perfect. And we are both retired with quotes around it, college professors. We say quotes because we still teach, both of us,
matter of fact,
at least one course per semester.
We just taught today, just came in.
All righty. So we are going to go back to the beginning of your story. How did you guys meet?
We met in Louisville, Kentucky, and I was in the military. I was at Fort Knox in 1967, and Edith was at really in college.
Yeah, I was a freshman. I was between my freshman and sophomore year, and we met in Sabbath school, Sunday school for some people, and I always say he was sitting across from me. And I was trying to focus on the lesson and he was focusing on me. That's my story.
And that's her story. That's the place we met. That's for sure.
Okay.
And I guess I was looking across the room and I saw her. And after the class, we went outside. We exited the class and then she came over to me. She's going to deny that.
I think if we mutually kind of connected.
All right.
Okay.
Clearly, we met each other. And it turned out we had mutual friends. We started talking and
kind of the rest is
history. Yeah. And I was from New York and she was from Kentucky, Louisville, Kentucky.
Okay, so from that, we're going to call it the mutual gravitation towards each other. I'm not picking sides. So it's the mutual gravitation towards each other. Who made the next move after that?
Well, you know, I believe in Southern hospitality.
Okay.
And so, poor soldier alone, I invited him to my house for dinner. I mean, that was just what a Southern hospitality requires, don't you think?
Yes, okay.
Okay.
That's my story, and I'm sticking with that one. So I invited him home for dinner, and pretty much he came to my house every other week for the rest of the summer.
There were other people. There were some people that wanted to.
Yes, there was.
Crash.
I remember one week, we laugh about this now. Someone called and said, you know, because once Trevor started coming to church, it turned out there were 6 or 8 other guys who wanted to come to church and also were members of the same faith community that we were. And so they...
some were just, they were interested in coming to see the girls at the church.
Whatever it was. So it was about 6 or 7 guys coming every week to church.
And in my little red Volkswagen.
Oh, no.
We all got in there, but yeah.
And so one week, a young lady called me and she said, Edith, what happened to all of the soldiers? I said, well, I don't know. She said, well, I was going to invite some home for dinner. I said, that's wonderful. You should. She said, I'm especially looking for the guy with the red Volkswagen. I said, oh, that's not an option. What? Oh, that one's taken. He's got dinner. Don't worry.
His plate is being made. Don't worry.
Yeah.
Yes, exactly. You know, find someone else. I've got there are 5 other guys. Let me get some help with those, but don't worry about him.
And that's really, really the beginning of the story. That time on, I attended that church
and Sabbath school.
And Sabbath school. We really got to know each other. And but I, as I said, I was in the military, and so I was at Fort Knox. And coming up very shortly after, I got my orders for Vietnam. This was about, we met in 67. Summer, and then by the time spring rolled around, I got spring of 68. I got my orders for Vietnam, and left in end of March and
early April.
April. I always know the date of April because it was Martin Luther King's assassination of Martin Luther King. I arrived in Vietnam that same day. And heard of the chaos that was back in the United States at that time. So I will always remember April 4th date.
Mm-hmm. So did you guys keep in contact while you were overseas?
We wrote every day, just about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I wasn't sure, though, in the writing, whether it was really connecting in the sense that I didn't know whether... my lady was interested. It was kind of fuzzy at that time.
Well, there was a little period when, you know, absence makes the heart grow fonder, but when it's too long, you know, you might find other people. But when it all boiled down, nothing else worked. I mean, that other one fell apart. That's the best way to say it. So I stuck with this one.
So, yeah, so that and I came out of Vietnam in November, Thanksgiving Day, really. That's another date I'll remember. Thanksgiving date day as we call ETS out of service. And I thought I was going to get the opportunity to go home immediately, and they didn't feel the same way. And I had to stay in Oakland and in San Francisco area for the rest of the week. So, you know, that's how that's how the military was at the time. And so we, you know, after we got out, first thing I did was try to contact Edith, and we connected. And we started,
I came to your house for Christmas.
Yeah, that same Christmas, came to the house. And
I met your mom.
Met my family. And then I think I proposed at
this
time. Yeah.
I'm sorry, this is 1968?
68, right.
And we got married in 69.
We got married in 69. That's the 54 years.
Right.
August 10th.
So you went to his family for Christmas. Correct. That's kind of a big step. How was that?
Well, I enjoyed his film. You know, we what we realized over the years, one of the things that was significant for us is that we had similar core values. We think that's really important. And we are both from large families that are very gregarious, where there's lots of talking and fun and teasing and laughing. And so that it was like then with my family, except it was not my family. It was very nice. I enjoyed it.
We had lived in a big farmhouse.
Huge farmhouse. It had, I don't know how many bedrooms, but it had four or five bathrooms that I remember.
Yeah, about
six to eight bedrooms.
Well, we were a large family. So really,
it was eight
really,
of his family and six of mine. So
we needed space.
Yeah,
for sure. That's a lot of kids.
That is.
We used to live in the city and, you know, in projects, and it was really small. And my dad felt we needed a bigger space. And so we moved out of the city into the country. And it was literally a farmhouse, you know, it was a farmhouse. Mm-hmm. And it had all these extensions. I think the people before us must have built on, extended in so many different ways. That's what happened. Yeah.
So before you proposed, did you guys have any talks of marriage?
We kind of talked about we talked around it, but not directly. But I think it was, you know, 50 something years ago, you don't remember every detail, but it was like sort of an understood that this was a relationship that was serious
and moving in that direction.
Yeah. In fact, when in 67 for Christmas, you know, we met in 67 and for Christmas, he gave me a watch, which at that time was what people gave within my religious faith. And so I was like, so why are you giving me this watch? He said, I just think you need a watch. And I said, is there a meaning? And so,
there was no meaning to that. You needed a watch.
Yes. But, you know, I just wanted to make sure, you know, what was going on. So it was a big production because it was kind of some understood things. Yeah, I think.
Yeah. But when we were moving that direction, so by 68 December, I was at least inclined to move in the direction of a proposal. And we didn't do those proposals like they do today,
where,
you know, you set up a whole, you know, environment and flowers and works. I remember where it was.
He didn't go on his deeds.
I did ask her. And
I said, let me think about it.
Yeah. And she thought about it for,
I don't know,
a month.
I think you asked me again in January. And then I said, oh, you were really serious. I remember thinking,
it was a serious request.
So then I said,
but then you see, I had to talk to her father and mother, and all those things had to be taken care of. So we did that, you know, and my family was really excited about that because they loved Edith. So, you know.
Yes, his father. I don't know which trip it was. Your father kept saying, oh, there's a good store for wedding dresses.
So he was insinuating all kinds of things, you know. But yeah, they were high on my wife. So
nice.
I love the fact that you took time. Like, usually it's a quick yes, but you it's like, let me have some time and came back about it. Wow. So,
She's always cautious like that.
So then you guys talked it out. You eventually said yes. And then you got married within that year?
Correct. So I'm a planner.
Mm-hmm.
So, we were both in school. He came back and started college in Massachusetts. Okay. I was at the University of Louisville. Mm-hmm. And I went to summer school between my sophomore and junior year and between my junior and senior year, which meant I only had one semester left.
Oh, okay.
So I didn't want to get married in school while I was actually in school. So that turned out that we had to get married in the summer. So that was the first thing. So did we want to wait till 70? after I'd graduated, we talked about that. I think we decided we didn't want to wait that long because we'd been apart so much of our relationship. We had a long distance relationship. I mean, he was in Louisville when I went back to school in Michigan. Then when I came back to Louisville, he was in Vietnam. So we were tired of that. So the best thing turned out to be we could save up enough money working, et cetera, and get married in August. And that's what we did.
And then she had to finish it one semester.
I just had one semester left. And I thought that would be a breeze just to find, you know, I'd gotten the school where I was going, the University of Louisville, allowed all colleges and universities have residency requirements. Your last 30 hours have to be at their school. But I wrote a letter and got exempted from that. And so they allowed me to take my last 15 hours or whatever it was. I don't even remember how many hours it was, somewhere else. And so I thought I could take it at the school where he was, but they didn't have sociology majors. That's what I majored in. So I ended up going to the Clark University in Worcester, Mass. But I finished all my hours. Yes.
Wow.
And then I guess I was in my sophomore year.
Yeah. You didn't finish at 72.
Yeah. And so then we have concluded all of our degrees during the time that we've been married.
Correct.
So we have
6 degrees that we've gotten since we got married.
We had master's and
undergraduate master's.
And we went to different schools in the sense that she did her master's at BU, Boston University, and I did mine at Andrews in Michigan. And then she did her doctorate at Smith in Massachusetts, Smith College. And then I did my doctorate at Emory in Atlanta. So we were, and I should add, we also did, finished up a master's in California. So we were like back and forth cross country. So we did have.
But mostly together.
We were mostly, yeah. We
okay.
Physically together, except my program for my doctorate required that I spend 9 weeks in the summer in Massachusetts. But I mean, and my husband must have come up there 3 or 4 times.
Wow.
Yeah. So, yeah, we did it that way. We are not the ones that can say, you shouldn't go to school and get married because we did all of our degrees.
All 6 of our degrees were post-marriage.
Yeah.
Wow.
That's a lot. So what was that first year of marriage like?
Like first years of marriage?
We do a lot of premarital counseling. We tell people the first year of marriage is hell. You know, that's a word in the Bible. And so, you know, 2 people haven't lived together. And so this is when you find how different you are. Mm-hmm. Most women are really like neat and orderly and they like their kitchen a certain way.
Wife is not.
That's not me.
I'm not either.
Neat and orderly and he likes the kitchen a certain way. So very, very quickly we learned that we had these different rhythms. We laugh because I'm a rooster. I get up early and I'm like ready to talk
I'm an owl. So I like to sleep and in the morning, but she will get up.
I get up and start talking.
Yeah, she get up and start talking.
And then be sleeping.
And I turn over and I said, why is she talking?
Until one day he said to me, do you have to talk when you get up in the morning? I mean, can't you just be quiet?
So,
I was like,
so what was the option that you gave me?
I said to him, no, I said, I can be quiet, but only if I leave the bed. I cannot stay in the bed and be quiet. So I can stay in the bed and snuggle and be awake and maybe not talk, but still be in the bed. Or I can get out.
And she would get out.
And he didn't like that. He wanted me to stay in bed.
So that went on. And then with cell phones, then she gets up and she has, then the light on the phone is, you know, so now I still have to turn over. And
you know. But again, do you want me to leave the bed?
No.
So there you are.
So that's the option that I have to live with. So I am becoming more and more early riser because I've been married to this woman for 54 years. And it's, you're going to have to get up anyway. So, you know, with that kind of. And what gets me, it's really, which is interesting. Families are like this. My family, I can call them late at night. I can call them at 11, 12 o'clock and I can get somebody. My wife's family, you can't do that. They are going to bed at 9, 9:30, 8:30 sometimes.
My sister says she has to have 8 or 9 hours.
Yeah, and they're gone.
So, I have another sister who she might be sleeping at 6:30 or 7. Yeah. I mean, you know.
Goodness.
Yeah. So you but that also speaks to the whole issue of differences, cultural differences, ways of that people are raised, ways that people are living, how they live their life. And then what we found that, you know, we are from two different cultural background. I was born in Jamaica in the West Indies. I lived in the United States most of my life, however, which was from the age of 7. But my wife was, was born in Louisville, Kentucky, and have generations of people there. Whereas my people have come and moved. They maybe have moved here, and then, you know, then they've scattered around the country. So they live in Texas and New York and Florida. And her family, most of them live in Louisville. You can find a whole family of living in Louisville. She's, you know, a Clay. And they're all a part of, this is Muhammad Ali's family, and they're all a part of, you know, that environment. You can go there and find a whole family there. Very few are gone from, and that's lately now that has happened.
Wow. Well, because you guys both come from big families, did you guys have a big wedding?
We had a relatively big wedding. I mean, by that I mean, for the 1960s, I had, I don't know, 5 or 6 bridesmaids and groomsmen, but it was mostly family. I don't think I had one friend.
I don't know.
I had my sisters, all 4 of my sisters, and 1 or 2 of your sisters. Your sister was the, I was really, it was big. Gish.
But by those standards.
For Louisville at that time, it was a big wedding. And then this is a different cultural addition. Okay. At that time in the 60s, Louisville, Kentucky, when you had a wedding, for you served the guests petit fours or small little cakes and hors d'oeuvres. That was it.
My family.
Very nice. The reception was very, no, and it's in the basement of the church. It's, you know, dress it up and whatever. So his family comes down and they go like, "Where's the food?" I was like, "Food? What?"
Believe in a serious meal for a wedding. So, matter of fact, we went to a wedding last night, and they were Trinidadian and African.
Yeah, they had
Trinidad and Tobago, and the groom was from Nigeria. They believe in a spread. Food. Yeah, you have to have a spread. You have to have fufu. You have to have chicken. You have to have goat. You have to have roti. You got the works, you know. Because they believe.
But when we went to Trevor's family, we had 2 receptions. The reception in the north was the traditional Caribbean reception. But I want to say that because I believe that America has been transformed by the influx of people from other countries. The Italians make it a big deal. The Greeks make it a big deal. The Caribbeans make it a big deal. But growing up, prior to my introduction to Trevor's family and in the Northeast, no one had, everybody did this. Little herbs and little sandwiches, petit fours, it was, you know, punch. And that was what you did. And these little cups, and it was all very, that's it. She's laughing at us.
Trevor, did you tell her what your family was expecting for a reception?
I don't know if we talked about that.
No, it's only when his family came.
Hey, like they were.
And that's the thing.
Yeah, I don't think I'd even paid any attention before that time. But my sisters would naturally, and I guess my dad too would have.
Your dad and your brother. Say,
"What's this? Where's food."
Because my family is also from the Caribbean.
Oh.
And we were like, there are things that I'm like, if I have a wedding, there are things that have to be there because my family anticipates it. Yeah. It doesn't matter what culture my groom is from. These things have to be there. So I have to let him know. It's like, oh, you want it to be hors d'oeuvres? That's cute. My family's going to be expecting a full meal.
Full-blown meal.
Talk bad about us if we don't.
Yes, exactly.
With black cake to include it.
Plenty of black cake, yes.
But they would have multiple desserts, multiple of everything. Meats were, you know, that's just the way it was. They believed in it.
I can truly say in Louisville now, anyone who has a wedding, they have a big production. But it's really now based on, I believe, the influence of people who come to America.
That's their expectation, I guess.
So what was it like, you guys, when you transitioned to becoming parents?
Well, you know, we really planned to start our family. Meaning we were married for six years. Okay. Our daughter was born in 75.
Oh, okay. You
know, we were married in 69. So we really planned and we wanted to finish maybe some of the degrees.
Okay.
So we had four of the degrees done before we became parents. Again, I'm a planner, and we thought about it. And when we were thinking about the kind of questions you might ask us, we actually planned. We were like, okay, we're getting off all birth control. You know, I went to the doctor. The doctor said everything was good. And I remember coming home and said, let's start working on the family. So, and he was very cooperative. He was quite willing to. So we planned definitely. So we were excited to be parents.
Yeah, we did. And we were finishing up my master's degree. Edith had already finished. Mm-hmm. And we were in, we actually drove to California from Michigan with, with the expectation that, and she was pregnant at the time, and I was doing a last quarter of school. And so that's how we did it, you know, and our daughter was born in California. Interesting thing. She was born there and went to school there. Her doctorate was at school there. So she's a physician. And she went back to the place of her birth to go to school. So I always think that was interesting that she did that.
Yeah, we left California when she was maybe 6 weeks old.
Yeah.
And so she told people she's from California.
What was it?
You are not from California. You're from Alabama.
But she said.
Yeah, so I would say parenting, marital satisfaction for most couples, and I'm sure we were in that group, goes down with children because children require so much care. And so it was a challenge. It was demanding. one of the ways we did it is I didn't work outside the home at all for my daughter, and I worked part-time with our son. And daughter.
Okay.
It just turned out that was easier. Yeah. And that was less of a strain on the family.
And we moved from California to New York. Okay. Yeah. Straight across. And then we lived in the Times Square area. Because I was an associate pastor and we were right in the theater district. We heard sunrise, sunset. Every single night.
Yeah, it was a guy with a
violin
and had his violin case open.
And we're in the front apartment right before 47, the theater right on 47th Street there. And so we would hear it, you know, and went to bed hearing sunrise and sunset, you know. So that's the only song he played.
he played other songs. Yeah, he just came to the end and you'd hear that every night. So we found parenting challenging, but not so challenging that we didn't work on it together as a team.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. We said earlier about the core values. We believe in core values that we had, and we think we definitely had core values of hard work and religious experience that we thought was a part of this, and we wanted an education became because we got our degrees while we were married, and we wanted, you know, we thought education was important for our children. We did not tell them. Both of them are, one is a dentist and the other is a physician, and we didn't say anything about doing that. They just accepted the prospect that they were going to go to the school, and they made a decision about their profession. I don't, you know, people always wonder, well, how do you all work that out? You have, you know, four doctorates in the family. Well, we didn't work that out. I think that, I think it may have evolved because the fact that we were in school. And then, see, we became professors at the schools, at the university. And so I think it almost was a natural thing for them to do that.
So during that time of when your children were younger, how did you guys make time for each other?
It was hard, but one of the things that we tell young couples when we're doing premarital is making time for each other has to be intentional. So here are some things that we did. We would walk together. We go out for a walk.
Ride our bikes together.
We did ride bikes. You know, because he was a professor, before that he was a pastor, we had some flexibility in time. So you could do things when the kids are taking the nap, you could do something, you know, and then they were in school. You could do things in the daytime when they're in school and you're not. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't have to be expensive. I told people, we were real fans for many years of Wendy's. I'm not advertising them now, but they had a $1 menu and you could get a baked potato for 99 cents.
And a glass of water.
Correct. And then you could get, the Frosties, they were 99. So the biggest thing is making time, and it doesn't have to be expensive. Yeah. So we did work to do that.
And it was, it now becomes a thing that we can say that you can do things without thinking that it has to be so expensive and so elaborate. You can do something as simple, but you can stay within your means, and you will be able to work out things together, because the whole idea is that you spend time together. That's what you want to do. So we do that.
You guys mentioned that you both came from large families. Was there a particular conversation that you had to keep your family as small as it was? Or was it one of those, like, whatever happens, happens?
No,
I know Edith says she's a planner, but
we plan not to have a big family. I mean, so when I was 12, maybe, and I read, you probably may or may not have heard of this book, Cheaper by the Dozen. It was a book about a family that had 12, and I was like, oh, I want a large family like this. But once I became mature and my frontal lobe was all developed, we knew we didn't want a large family. So, our son, we did want more than one child, but our son really was oops. And so I would have planned a little bit more time between the two.
Okay.
But he's an amazing son. So I don't regret it. If we waited later, we wouldn't have had this son. So.
Right. Well, as a fellow oops, we are a delight.
Yes, he's a delight.
So, you guys became empty nesters. Like, you had children in the house, you grew up, they grew up, and then they left the house. What was that like for it to just be the two of you again?
I guess it was hard. When they were in graduate school, people thought, because they both went to the same university in California, not that they had to, and we didn't say anything about them doing that, but people would say, you all seem to have moved to California. We really love our kids. And so we were at their white coat set, you know, their any little thing that they had out there, we were there. So we made it an effort to, and we vacationed together, you know, as a family, and traveled a lot together. So we really, really wanted to be with them. We still, and now we make, last night we were in our car setting our calendar up as we were traveling back from a wedding, with, you know, setting our schedule for the next 3 months about, you know, where we're going to spend the time with our children. We have, you know, and we do that for the holidays. We do that for, we actually do it for my mother, who is still alive at 95. And so we do spend time going back to and going with many of our vacations, even today, because we had family reunions of the both families separately and together. Consequently, we, a lot of our children will sometimes set it up with us and come with to our to the family. And so, yeah, that's what we have done. We have had a lot of vacation together. Our 50th anniversary was in Australia and New Zealand together.
Oh, wow.
You know, so, you know, and we have this summer we went on a mission trip with our grandson to Belize. So, yeah, we do. We have done a lot of things as a family together. So that sort of brings the cohesiveness. I think sometimes they probably want to get some space from us, but I think they also enjoy the time together too.
So I think initially, you know, I can remember feeling very kind of lost because I think I built a lot of my, I built my career around making sure I had time for the children. I mean, that's why academics was great, especially on the collegiate level. You teach two or three classes, you have space, you can do this. I mean, I can remember going over to the kids' school in the middle of the daytime because, you know, I wasn't seeing a student at that time. So and both of our kids went to the college where we taught. So even though they lived on campus, you know, my daughter came all the time, but my son would stop at least once or twice a week, you know, just to check in my office, check on us. And then he would come to the house once a week because, you know, you can't wash clothes at in the dorms. You have to come home where it's free.
Sure is.
Hey, yes, to come. But anyway.
And then he
was always going to move your clothes from the washer.
Yeah.
And you have unlimited time. It's better at home.
You understand.
Well, he also came home to empty the refrigerator.
Yes, he did. He left over that was in the refrigerator. So all of those. So when he finally left, I remember the Sabbath that was after he'd left. We were doing something in the church because we were both elders. And somebody said something, and I just started crying, and they had to come and take me out because I was like, my children. You know, it was an emotional time for me. I mean, I really did miss them. And in all honesty, the first year when my son was in dental school, not elementary school, I called him every day. Until my husband told me that you cannot call him every day. And by the way, he didn't answer. I would leave messages.
Oh, rude.
I'm just trying to see how you're doing. I just want to make sure you're okay. And he probably went, oh, it's her again. Oh, my God. So I eventually decided.
Had to wean herself off.
My husband's help. So for me, it was difficult.
So how much does spirituality play a role in your marriage?
So I like to tell couples when we're doing premarital counseling that on the honeymoon night, my husband said two things. People always go like, what is she going to say? the two things he said was, let's always have worship every day and let's never go to bed angry. I tell people we did so much better at the first one. So we have worked twice a day. You know, it's very much an important concept for us.
It's never a long period, but
yeah. If I'm away or he's away, we still have worship. We just call and have phone. In the mornings, we have probably for the last 2 years, we always did devotionals, but we have found couples devotionals. And those to us are amazing. And I'm going to do a shameless plug that we've written our own couples devotional called Saving Marriages, Navigating the Journey of Marriage in 100 Days. So it's also something that we recommend that couples. So we found that couples devotionals are just transformative because they are focusing on couples issues. They often ask questions. They often make you think and talk to each other. One of the first ones we did was something called the 5-minute couple devotional. And I wrote him afterwards and said that that wasn't true. It wasn't 5 minutes because half an hour after reading this devotional, we're still talking about what, you know.
And that was the important thing that the material created more communication that needed to occur. And that's what we found with the couple's devotion. With the other devotion, we may have said, may have been in touch with each other, but we'd usually close it up and we'd be done. But we found that the couple's devotions have been very significant because we talk about things about our marriage, about things that we sometimes want to share with couples that we are communicating with in counseling. So it has enriched our marriage and it has enriched others' marriage as well, because we felt that, you know, this is helpful to them. And we didn't realize how helpful it would be until we started doing it. And it became very empathic for us. It was clear that we needed to spend time that we didn't do before, and it really helped our marriage to grow. So we see the value in that.
So when we are working with couples who are in premarital counseling, we start off with, we do 6 sessions, and the first session is on spiritual intimacy, because we think that's the foundation, spiritual intimacy. And spiritual intimacy not only is reading a couple's devotional or whatever you're going to do, but it's also praying for each other. So we emphasize the importance of praying for each other all day long and keeping your spouse on your heart and in your prayer life. And so we one of the persons who was reading our couples devotional wrote us back and said she and her husband started praying for each other based on what they had read in our devotional. And she said, guess what? Everything we prayed for happened. Our prayers were answered. So, you know, I think that's so that tells you the foundation of our marriage is spiritual intimacy.
I mean, granted, you guys did meet in Sabbath school. Sabbath school. So that's right. You guys have carried that from the beginning all the way up until now so far. How did you guys exactly get into premarital counseling?
Well, pastoring a church sort of leads you into it. And maybe what it was even before that, when we were getting ready to get married, we went to our pastor in Louisville at the time to ask for pastoral counseling.
Premarital counseling.
And he said, oh, you two don't need it. You know.
And then he prayed for us and said, you know, see you at the wedding. Like, really? I mean, if it was a half an hour.
Yeah, it was probably about that.
If it was a half an hour.
He was a great guy.
Oh, really nice guy. A nicer man you could never find. But he said, Trevor, you come from a good family. Edith, you come from a good family. You guys are going to be fine. You don't need any premarital counseling. Let's pray.
But we have found, as we have, matter of fact, at this wedding last night, people there, some were our students, some were just, people who knew us as doing workshops. And they said, they're married now. And they said, we really need this help. I think the complication of our society demand that we provide some measure of instruction for people. It's not to be it's not a given that you know what to do. And with homes that are disrupted and broken up and all kinds of things, they don't have a model. Mm-hmm. So if you don't have a model, how do you know? And even if you did have a model in this day and age with all of the crisis, we just finished some workshops there last 2 weeks on mental health. And it is clear that people need the assistance that comes with that, with preparing for a marriage and surviving a marriage, because there is a survival need.
And once we came here, I think students began to, you know, they knew we did some things with couples and families. And so they said, well, do you do premarital? And so we've actually developed kind of our own modality. We've looked at others, but
they introduced pre-engagement.
Yes, actually they did. Students have asked us to do pre-engagement, mm-hmm. which means that we're in a committed relationship, but we don't know if we should go forward. And we have found several of those people, after that, they decide they don't want to keep going forward. And you know, and that's great. I think if you're going to break up, break up before you get married.
And break up when it's cheaper.
Yeah, absolutely. Less of a commitment. So that's how we got started. Just, you know, people requesting, pastoring churches, knowing that it's needed. And the final thing is we get training for almost everything. And you have driver's lessons. Mm-hmm. And that's so
use of clearly, equipment. For
absolutely.
Computers. Yeah.
So clearly people with so few models of what makes a good marriage need some insight. And so what we found is, we don't advertise. We don't have flyers. People just word of mouth. So-and-so got marriage counseling, pre-marriage counseling. They said you were great. Will you do it for us? And I'm like, oh, okay, sure. So, you know, that's what we do.
Yeah. And we have done it for pastors, we've done it for students, mm-hmm. we've done it for people in the community. We've also written a book on saving marriage by applying biblical wisdom. So that's our first book that we wrote, and we've done that. And so people have, they have seen that.
And we use that in our
and they get it on Amazon.com. And so they ask us about it. And so that's part of what has triggered other people coming to us. Matter of fact, you remind me, I got to call somebody because they called me yesterday and wanted to set up something. So I need to do that too. It's really a need. It's a need. And that's all we're doing is meeting that need.
In your 54 years of marriage, what would you say has been the best thing so far, or your favorite part about marriage so far?
So a good marriage requires communication. Mm-hmm. And I think it helps if you're friends.
Yeah.
You know, if you like the person, not just love the person, but like them. I think that's what's worked for us.
And we have a lot of fun together. So we can play together. We can, we can travel together. We travel with other people on cruises and things like that. So, we are friends. And we have been friends a long time with this. You know, there are so many things that we enjoy in common. And so that has been part of that. And travel has been. Now, my wife has a bucket list. So she travels, wants to travel a lot more. She's done some.
Yes, he doesn't like to travel as much.
But we've
visited 6 of the 7 continents. So we have to visit the 7th one, right?
What's your last one?
I would assume so.
Antarctica.
Oh, okay.
Ooh, good luck with that Drake's Passage.
Here's the thing. I met a lady about 4 years ago who was in her 80s, and she just come back from from Antarctica. So you kind of fly down to like South America and then they take a boat. They don't, the cruise doesn't stay that long at Antarctica. I just want to touch. No. Yeah. So there we are. So again, that's another thing that makes our marriage. We're always growing, always doing something different.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but there's some things I'm not going to do like what she's done now, because she has jumped out of a plane. I'm not doing that. Skydiving. Yeah. I'm not doing that one. So
you only live once.
I'd like to keep doing it.
Yeah. So that's what we've done. You know, that's some of who we are. And we are also trying to finish up a book, and I'm the one dragging behind. So, but we're going to get it done.
I'm not saying a word.
So, Edith, what is your favorite thing about Trevor? And Trevor, what is your favorite thing about Edith?
So, I always say that Trevor is like my gyroscope, my foundation. As you can see, I'm I've been impetuous. I'm even though I like to plan, I'm impetuous. I'm like, okay, I'm not gonna do that. You know, I'll flare up and it'll be all over. And Trevor's the calm, you know, presence, you know, that keeps me on point and on focus. And he's kind of cute on top of it. He's got big brown, you might not know it. He's got big brown, gorgeous eyes. And I kind of like his bald head.
You have to put up with it now. I think what charms me about Edith is that her excitement in about life and excitement in doing things and pushing us to do things that sometimes is, you know, it's off the chart and off the chain, you know. So that's you know, some I go dragging, kicking and screaming, but that's what I like about her. And she's always been that way. So yeah, that's what
in the early year we were laughing about this. We got into a disagreement around our first anniversary because I got up one morning and said, let's go to Cape Cod today, which is where we did our honeymoon. And he's like, what? We can't go. We've got to get tires for the car. We have to do this. I said, oh, it's so boring. So argument about, you know, and I must confess, I've learned that you can't just get up in the morning and go on a 4-hour trip without, you know,
some plan.
Some planning.
Yeah. So
speaking of that, how did you guys handle conflicts that came up in your marriage?
Well, we have had this rule. We will probably really argue about something, but we will come back and say that we can't just let it go for a long period of time. Mm-hmm. So we have to, we recommend 24 to 48 and not greater than hours and not greater than 72 hours.
To come back
and talk about things. So we don't really let it simmer that much, but if it does, you know, people get in bed and don't want to touch each other's feet, you know, and all that kind of stuff. And why is that? And you really have to, you know, you have to come to Jesus moment, you know, where you need to talk with each other. And my thing is really always to confess that I've done something wrong. And what can we do to make up?
He's much better at confessing and saying he's sorry than I am. He really is. He's very good at it.
You like to hold on to this.
I do. I just think he needs to suffer more. Yes, you know, you said 24 to 48 hours. Not so funny, dear. But he's right. We had a disagreement. And you know, I will come back. So I'll go, what went wrong? What happened? You know, so because, you know, 95% of all couples disagree. Disagreements are something all the couples are going to have. So we just need to figure out what really happened. And so many years ago, we went to it wasn't a podcast. It was Elder Kelly's program that he has on Sabbath afternoons. And he talked about the fact that he and his wife had recurrent arguments. And he said they boiled them down into four categories. And he said they would start an argument and somebody would say, oh, that's number two. You know, and that's
so they labeled the argument.
That stuck with me. And I think many of us have recurrent arguments around themes that are not resolved. And so just because it's not resolved now doesn't mean it's not resolvable. So you just keep working at it so you understand each other better.
What would you say is the quote unquote secret for your long lasting marriage?
Well, we have said friendship and the fact that I really love this woman more than anything else. And so, you know, she would have to, you know, I don't know, do something crazy. And, but, you know, when you love someone and you're committed to that relationship, I think that's the secret, really. That's the secret of our staying together.
I'd say good communication, being willing to take risk and being vulnerable, sharing your true self, and trying to understand what's going on from the other person's perspective, being empathic. And then, of course, you know, we said friendship. And of course, we already talked about, you know, here's the thing I told the couples too. You know, when we've had an argument and we've disagreed, and then we get down at, because we have worship in the morning and at night. So you're at night, you had worship, and you get, you're praying and you're mad. You know how hard it is to stay mad and be praying? I've done it. That's why I tell you that. Not with pride, I'm just being honest. But it's not easy. You know, the Holy Spirit is like saying, Ida, come on. So I really think that has been an integral part, you know. So communication, friendship, commitment, love, and having God at the as the foundational component of this relationship.
Well, first of all, Edith and Trevor, I want to say thank you guys so much for taking time out of your schedule to come and talk to us and share with us a little bit about your guys' journey. But before we let you guys go, we do have one last question that we ask all of our guests. And that question
is marriage worth it?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. We would do it over again.
Yeah. Easy. If I had to go back to that freshman, between the freshman and sophomore year in college, and looking across the room in the Sabbath school class as I'm trying to focus on the lesson. And so this cutie pie, I'd marry him again.
And there you have it. It is an absolutely from Edith and Trevor. You guys can go ahead and plug your guys' books and where our listeners can find them if they are interested.
We have two books, Saving Marriage, and it's they're both on Amazon. The other one is, well, she's audio. The other one says Saving Marriage, Navigating the Journey of Marriage in 100 Days. So one's a devotional. We kept with the name because we thought that would help people who had purchased earlier ones. And they're, you know, if you don't see it under Saving Marriages, just put in our names and it should come up. When I go on Amazon, I see them. And so there they are. And we'd love to, you know.
And we have a website as well if people want to. Christian Family Seminars. Christian Family Life Seminars, I think is what it is. Christian Family Life Seminars.
We think we're not really good at our website because, you know, when we got married, we were laughing last night. When we got married, we didn't have a phone. At first, at all.
Use phone.
So we use the phone booth. So you guys don't even know about that.
I know what a phone booth is. I just can't imagine not having a phone.
Yes, we didn't have a phone. So we used a phone booth until January. We got married in August. So August, we would go to the phone booth. You had to have enough coins. She gave her a headache, Trevor.
No, you would. You would have to get enough coins and you call somebody. And that's if fine. They didn't pick up, I don't know what happens next.
Well, you get your money back. Yeah, it would
fall. But if they pick, if the answering machine
picks up, you lost your money.
You lost your money. Yeah. So, you know, but the bigger thing was more like you're talking to people and they'll stop and say, you need to deposit $1.25. So you're trying to find some more quarters to talk. So we did that for, what, 5 months? September, October, November, December, January. Yeah, 5 months. No phone at all, except the phone booth.
And, so, and we didn't have.
And any. we were in Massachusetts. So I want you to think about
when it's cold.
December going to the phone.
And I don't think we had one near the house where we were
staying. I don't think we did either.
So we had to go to
get in our car and drive to a phone booth.
Yeah. So
those were the good old days.
No, hardly good.
Not really.
And we look at our grandchildren with their phones and they don't even know what a phone booth is. And really, you know.
No, they do. They don't know anything about snail mail either. So
no, you're talking about how you had to send letters to Vietnam. Like,
just. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I can't even send a mail down the street to her house.
Every day. And, you know, he would get, mail that he'd written 3 or 4 or 5, because the military did try to speed them up. But as you can see, we like to laugh. I should have put laughter in that thing. But our grandson turned 17 a couple of weeks ago. And so old fashioned grandma got a card and put money in the card to send to him. And his mother said, Mimi sent you some money in the mail. And I mailed it off on Tuesday. And when she told him Tuesday afternoon, he went running to the mailbox to get the money. Like, no. It's snail mail. And he texted me. I said, Mimi, why didn't you just cash up or Zelle? So that was the last time I'll put money in the mail for him. I mean, I was thinking the card, and he didn't care about that.
So. He just wanted the money.
He just wanted the
money. And fast. So, yeah.
Well, thank you so much again, Edith and Trevor, for being a part of our Is Marriage Worth It podcast.
All right. You're welcome.
You're welcome. Thank you so much for the invitation. Have a good one.
You can follow us on TikTok, Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at Marriage Worth It. You can also email us at marriageworthit@gmail.com.
I'm Monique.
And I'm Janelle.
And this has been
Is Marriage Worth It?